From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a closer look at the mushrooming ignition switch crisis at GM with more than 3 million new recalls.
Engineers who are in charge of in these safety committees are saying to themselves, not on my watch.
Plus, more than 500,000 Michigan kids could be getting free lunches this summer. Why aren't they?
So many people think of summertime as this very carefree time for kids, and that's true. But for many kids, it can be a time of great stress and food insecurity.
Poet and writer Keith Taylor checks in with his picks for your summer reading, and food seems to be front and center.
Carrots were, after all, roots. The cold dark was where they'd thrived before they'd been yanked out of the ground. Why wouldn't they mistake the refrigerator for the earth?
Those stories and more today. General Motors is recalling some 3.4 million more cars in the U.S. because of ignition switch problems. The recall is part of a GM review of its ignition switches after the company recalled 2.6 million small cars earlier this year for a similar problem, and all of that linked to 13 deaths and over 40 crashes. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we talk about what these additional recalls might mean for consumer confidence and GM sales. Then poet and writer Keith Taylor will stop by with his picks for your summer reading list. And you might be surprised which Michigan authors made his list. That's in 15 minutes. But first, state lawmakers are now back home on week one of their 12-week summer break. They're home campaigning without having passed any way to raise the money needed to fix Michigan's crumbling roads. That failure got a lot of drivers hopping mad, which in turn triggered a healthy round of spin and blame from our elected representatives. Chris Gouts is the Lansing reporter for Crane's Detroit Business. And Chris, no road repair plan gets passed by the state Senate. Drivers are clear they want the roads fixed. They're mad. And yet Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville had said the failure was, in his words, not that big a deal, really. Really? How is that?
Yeah, I think that came as a little bit of a surprise when he said that. You know, sometimes Senator Richardville can have sort of a dry sense of humor, but, you know, when he said that, some people sort of view that as, you know, him trying to put lipstick on a pig because they just didn't do anything. I mean, they spent 25 hours on the last 2 days of session and didn't raise a single dollar in new revenue for the roads. But his point, what he was trying to make, and probably not so artfully, was that this money was going to be included in the next year's budget, and so we wouldn't see that money till October, and some of the things wouldn't start generating revenue until January, and so then you're talking about next year's construction season. So all of the big, you know, monumental changes that they were trying to make to our state's transportation funding system were long-term fixes and weren't going to fill a pothole on your street, this summer. So I think that's what we're trying to get at, but it didn't help matters any the way you said it, probably.
Now, Republicans, as you point out in your piece for Cranes on your blog, that Republicans are pointing to that $286 million in the state budget, saying, hey, that's already been approved. It takes effect October 1st. It's going toward roads. But as you point out, well, maybe not all of it.
No, not all that money. And really, when you talk with Senator Richardville and some others, not only are they trying to claim that they put that money into it, but they're also trying to add together a whole bunch of other things that ranges anywhere from $600 million to $900 million that the legislature has put towards roads. And they seem to be getting that by counting the $300 million that's in this year's budget plus that $286 that we just talked about. And then this other $200 million that comes through this bill that allowed for diesel parity. But that's really intellectually dishonest in a whole host of ways. I mean, first of all, the diesel parity bill isn't law. It did pass the Senate, but it hasn't passed the House, and it's connected in what they call tie-barred to a bill that's tie-barred to another bill to raise the gas tax, which obviously didn't come even close to a vote. So you can't say that that money's there. It's not even close to happening.
Okay.
And then the $330 million or so that they're counting in this year's budget, about 120 or so that is for federal matching funds. Another 115 was for priority road projects that went almost exclusively to districts controlled by Republicans, which we've talked about before.
We did.
And then I think another $100 million that they're counting here is for winter maintenance, which was money that MDOT and local road officials were already going to be requesting anyway because of how severe this past winter was. And then the money this time around, the majority of that is, almost the majority of it is just federal matching money, which they do every year when the fees and taxes don't allow them to meet the federal match. And then another $15 million or so is for airport improvements and high-speed rail, and not anything to do with the road. So maybe a quarter of that $900 million figure that you're going to hear talked about by your lawmakers is probably actually really going to fix the roads, depending on how you what you included there.
So as senators and representatives are out campaigning this summer, what do you think they might hear from constituents?
Well, they're probably going to hear a very confusing and frustrating message. They're going to say, thank you for not raising my taxes, and why didn't you fix the roads? I think is what they're going to hear, and therein lies the problem as to why they couldn't get anything done. I mean, you're going to have some that are going to say, absolutely, please raise my taxes because I want to get these roads fixed. That's why they opposed having any sort of tax cut in the budget, which, you know, ended up coming to fruition. But there's going to be a lot of frustration about fixing the roads, but the lawmakers might be benefited by, you know, the fact that there's going to be some money to fix potholes, and the roads won't be as bad as they are now in a couple months. And they're also going to be able to go around and they'll put flyers in people's doors and say, you know, actually we did put this $280 million this year in the budget. You know, there is money this year. But when lawmakers come to your door and they tell you that, ask them what they're counting and make them be specific, because they're probably counting some things that aren't really money that's going to fix the potholes in front of your house.
Chris Gouts, Lansing reporter for Crane's Detroit Business. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
Did you know one cow, just one cow, produces, get ready, 10,000 gallons of manure every year? So do the math a little. A large farm with 1,000 cows means 10 million gallons of manure each and every year. Well, now thanks to research from Michigan State University, that cow poo could become the source of, believe it or not, clean, usable water. Steve Safferman's an associate professor of biosystems and agricultural engineering at Michigan State University. Good to have you with us, Steve.
Oh, thank you.
I can only imagine that a common reaction when people talk to you about your work is, how did the idea happen of turning cow poo into water?
Yes, I think the most important thing to realize that 90-95%, even more, of the manure is water. So it's mainly composed of water. And as we hear more and more about water shortages and the expense to treat water, it just makes sense to investigate, can we recover that water out of that manure?
And how do you do that? How does this process happen?
Well, it's a multi-step process, and it requires first going through pretreatment, and that's an anaerobic digester, and that helps, in a sense, mix everything together and release some of the water out of the soil structure within the manure. And then we go through a series of filtration steps, air stripping, and then reverse osmosis to finally get the water to the point of being able to be reused.
And how much water might you get? Let's take 100 gallons of cow manure. How much water are you able to extract from that?
It looks like right now my colleague who's actually working on this research commercially, Jim Wallace, is able to get about 50 gallons, so 50% of the water out from 100 gallons of manure. He's aiming to increase that number a little bit to hopefully 65 gallons of water out from 100 gallons of liquid manure.
And what kind of water do you get? I guess one of our staffers was saying, well, I don't think I'd want to drink that, but that isn't right. The point, right?
Well, it's kind of interesting because going through reverse osmosis provides a very, very high level of treatment. All the viruses are out. Lots of the other constituents, metals, are out. So it actually becomes likely safe for cow drinking, for the cows to drink. Definitely safe for any irrigation or surface water discharge, much, much cleaner than what we treat our typical domestic wastewater to. So the water looks actually like regular fresh water that we see out of the faucet.
Steve, what are the prospects of commercializing this system of converting cow manure into water and getting it into the hands of farmers?
It looks pretty good, really. There, within a year of commercializing it, we've had a lot of interest where farmers have inquired about it. And even in Michigan, where we don't think of ourselves as having water shortages, is an amazing number of farms who've had to actually dig deeper wells and there's a cost to pump that water out. So even in Michigan, there's interest in this, but definitely a lot of interest in some of the southwestern states where they're under drought conditions. And also it tends to, what we have found is that some of the well water is not actually of very high quality, and this water has actually higher quality levels for drinking, for cattle drinking, than some of the well water that we pump.
Boy, so ultimately, how great an impact, Steve, do you think that this McClanahan nutrient separation system, as it's known, how much of an impact could that have on the finances for farmers and on helping the environment?
Well, you know, it really could be absolutely critical for some farmers, where we've heard of cases where, and we've seen it on the news, where farmers are having to sell their livestock because they just don't have water for their livestock. And this is a way of cutting their water use substantially, potentially in half, if not more, in terms of raising the livestock. And so that could be a tremendous impact. If you don't have water, you can't have a farm, obviously. So by being able to recirculate a good portion of your water, that might enable some farms to even remain in business. So it could be even more important than increasing profitability. It could be survival of some of these farms.
Steve Safferman is an associate professor of biosystems and agricultural engineering at Michigan State University. And I think it's safe to say, Steve, you've given us some new respect for the humble cow pie.
Yes, indeed.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Summer officially rolls in here this Saturday, June 21st. And book lovers, a new season means it's time for us to sit down with poet and writer Keith Taylor and get his picks for our summer reading. Keith coordinates the undergrad creative writing program at the University of Michigan. Always good to have you with us, Keith. And I cannot believe another season has passed and it's time for us to talk again.
It is indeed. It's great. And I was thinking about summer reads and I was, you know, the big books that everybody's talking about.
Yes.
I've read some of them and they're great. I mean, that Donna Tartt novel, The Goldfinch, you know, that's going to be a great book for people to curl up in the cabin up north and glue themselves for a week. But I'm talking about books that aren't necessarily summer reads.
Yeah, you like to challenge us.
Well, yeah, I do. And this is, you know, this is a challenge today. This is unexpected. They're all Michigan people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's that consistency. I wanted to start with the new novel by Laura Kaziski. I know you've talked to her.
Yes.
But we'll have, you know, we'll have my take on the book.
I'm anxious to hear it.
Good. It's called The Mind of Winter. And it's interesting to find there's always been, I've been reading Laura now for 25 years, and there's always been an urgency in her writing. It always feels as if she has to get this done. Mm-hmm. It's got to be written. There's something very important that depends upon it. I get that sense of urgency, and I think that it has had something to do with the success that she has found. Her books are demanding, and there is no easy emotion in any of them,
yeah.
Yet she seems to be finding more and more readers. In this country, she probably receives the greatest critical accolades as a poet, and she won the National Book Critics Circle Award as a poet. And her novels don't get the attention that the poems do, I think. Overseas, however,
mm-hmm.
she's best known for her novels by far.
Okay.
This new one, The Mind of Winter, for instance, was a bestseller in France months before it was even released in English.
Interesting.
So, I mean, the French are just sort of waiting for, and it got onto the, like, you know, number three or four in the bestseller.
Gobbled right up.
Exactly. So, you know, we don't know what will happen to it in the States, but she certainly has this gigantic audience in Europe. So this is one of this, The Mind of Winter, is one of those novels that shows a writer's skill. It all takes place in one day. You imagine how hard it would be to write a book like that?
Yes.
Like you don't have that chance for moving around. Everything has to be backstory. The day here is a Christmas day sometime in the early 2000s. This is sounding stranger and stranger for a summer reading. But if we have to use a cliche for summer books, it is indeed spine tingling.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's reason enough to take it to the beach. Although all through the book, there's a gigantic blizzard. It's covering everything outside the window of the character Holly's suburban home, forcing all of the guests who are going to come to Christmas dinner to cancel. Her husband leaves early and has to take care of his very ill parent. The mother and daughter, the daughter that she adopted from Russia, mm-hmm. are left alone together in the house.
And the daughter is a teenager.
Oh, aren't you glad you're done with that? So they're left alone, but then you kind of wonder, or are they?
Mm.
Holly awakened that morning with something in her brain, something she might think might be a line of poetry. That line is, something had followed them home from Russia. Over the years, Kaczynski has mastered the sort of sense of atmosphere in her books, one where the reader isn't quite sure what's real, whether we're dealing with psychological breakdown or the terrors of the supernatural.
I almost got a Stephen King vibe.
Well, you know, I don't think she'd be. I don't think she'd hate that. Yeah,
I love
yeah.
because that's what when yeah. he's writing well.
Yeah. And I think if we were to make a line there between yeah. psychological breakdown and mm-hmm. the supernatural, he mm-hmm. might go a little more toward the supernatural.
Yes.
And she comes back and goes a little more to psychological
but
breakdown.
But you're left going, yeah. oh, what's going on? And the sense of atmosphere
right.
And,
right.
and threat.
Right. Yeah. This is a scary book.
Yeah.
We, you know, I mean, this we said it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
So throughout this book, the mother busies herself preparing a meal that will never be served, while the daughter withdraws further and further into a world the mother doesn't seem to understand. We really have to wait until the very mm-hmm. last page to find out what's happening. And I just have to – if anybody's going to read this book, the people who are following Laura or people who want to start reading her – don't read that last page.
No,
Force yourself not to read
right.
ahead. It really will ruin this book if you read the last page.
She
You've
does do a tremendously good job of capturing the mother-teenage daughter dynamic.
Doesn't she? Doesn't,
well, those I mean, of us who have walked in those shoes.
I had only observed that from the father's point of view. But she's, you know, Laura's become really an interesting prose stylist, and she can describe these things, the simplest things, and make them really scary. I just want to read you a
yes.
tiny little paragraph about carrots. So while preparing the dinner, she takes the carrots out of her fridge and she notices that even though she's only had them a couple of days, they've become kind of hairy or kind of a little weird. Well, she supposed it was natural that carrots might continue to grow after being closed up in the cold dark of the refrigerator crisper for a couple of days. Didn't they say that the hair and fingernails of a corpse continued to grow in the grave? Carrots were, after all, roots. The cold dark was where they'd thrived before they'd been yanked out of the ground. Why wouldn't they mistake the refrigerator for the earth? Holding the whole bunch under the faucet, letting the water from the tap run over them, it was easy to imagine them underground, the way they would be feeling their way around down there, like long, creeping fingers. That's carrots she's
That's
talking
carrots.
About. Which so, is, yeah. you know, something.
And I also was struck with the way that the storm became a character.
Oh, yeah, the storm is just
really
out there. And it's very scary.
Well, you know, I would say that's a good one to read when it's about 95 in August
exactly.
and you're suffering exactly. from the humidity and you want
I
to realize.
That too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good
yeah,
choice. So that is The Mind of Winter by Laura Kaczynski.
Mm-hmm. The next one is a memoir by Sue Williams Silverman. She lives over in Grand Haven. It has one of the best title-subtitle combinations of the year. The Pat Boone Fan Club, colon, or My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew.
I love this.
I think those of us who remember Pat Boone
Absolutely.
Find the humor in that. Okay, there's probably going to be some of your readers who don't remember him, though, which is kind of – he's still around.
He is.
Right. If anybody needs an explanation of who he was, think tremendously successful bubblegum rock and roll from the 50s and early 60s.
Exceptionally clean cut.
Squeaky clean.
Yeah, Elvis
Squeaky
was dangerous
clean.
With
right.
his blue suede shoes.
Right.
Pat
right.
Boone had his white box,
exactly,
and he was squeaky,
exactly, the
squeaky
white
clean.
Box. I saw him in a Los Angeles airport, by the way, and I turned to my wife and said, he's really wearing white shoes. And
know.
He heard me.
Oh, dear.
But he never really went away. He's been around. He sort of
yes.
had a post-life, and
yeah.
he sings a lot at conservative political conventions and religious events and things like that. So this title is funny on the surface, but it gets less so as we learn more about it. Silverman's written two previous memoirs, terrifying books about being sexually abused as a child and the devastating effects of that abuse in later life. For that child, Pat Boone became the symbol of everything good and pure she couldn't find at home.
Mm-hmm.
Her fantasies about him and his family were her escape. She wanted to give up herself, which included her ethnicity, her Jewishness, for what she imagined was a bland and painless waspishness.
Ooh.
So this book of deeply personal essays becomes an exploration of identity. Silverman asks herself who she is and why she was so attracted to a star who was otherwise so bland. She discovers a lot along the way about herself and about Pat Boone, by the way, who
okay.
she still sees, who she just was with him on his 80th birthday, which
oh,
is kind of
goodness.
Fun. Here's the conclusion she comes with Pat Boone. Again, beautiful, beautiful writing in this little paragraph. Pat Boone is innocent, all-American teenage summers at Palisades Park. Bermuda shorts and girls in shirtwaist dresses, corner drugstores, pearly nail polish, prom corsages, rain-scented lilacs, chenille bedspreads and chiffon scarves, jukebox rock and roll spilling across humid evenings, back when linoleum was better, more real than wood. He is ivory soap, grape popsicles, screen porches at the Jersey shore, bathing suits hung to dry, the smell of must and mildew tempered by sun and salt. He is a boardwalk Ferris wheel, its spinning lights filling dark spaces between stars. He remains all the things that, as you age, you miss, the memory of this past smelling sweeter than honeysuckle on the 4th of July. And she goes on and talks about memory and nostalgia.
Sue Williams Silverman, that's some writing.
She's something. She's interesting.
The Pat Boone fan club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. What a memoir. That's a great title.
It's a provocative book.
All right.
So the next one's very, very different. It's a book of short stories by Detroit's Lolita Hernandez. The title is Making Callaloo in Detroit. Although she was born and raised in Detroit and worked for over 40 years in factories there or for the UAW, Hernandez is from a small community of island people in the city, people who came up from the Caribbean to find a better life in the factories and then, like so many others, were left behind when the economy and the technology changed.
Okay.
Now, I did not know there was a Caribbean community in Detroit until I met her. But, of course, it makes sense that there would be. I mean, it's a big city and people came from all over.
Sure.
So, but I found that out because of her. These stories are often deeply moving, even sad, but they're always a celebration of her community. They become a kind of song about the mix of food and story, the stories these people tell each other, the food they make for each other. And, of course, of the living and the dead who become all a part of this song. And Detroit is always there, and Detroit and the memory of the islands that these people came from.
And such a mix between Detroit, the gritty Motown, and
absolutely.
Islands.
Absolutely. And
wow.
this image of those warm islands.
Yeah.
I had a quick sort of very informal interview with her a couple of weeks ago. And told her I was going to talk about it. And she said she was going to enjoy listening to me mispronounce words and trying to get the speech rhythms wrong. But here there's a couple of passages I want to read from this one. Here's the first one from her introduction, her preface, where she talks about these stories themselves. These stories are not an attempt to capture my culture through food. I didn't try. This just happened. Call it gut memory. Stuff stuck in the craw, can't expel, still burping up the flavors of real pepper sauce and my beloved bacalao, boujol, and bakes. Callaloo is a metaphor like no other for all of this, a stew of dasheen leaves, okra, and some kind of protein, crab or salt pork, and maybe some coconut, served over rice or not. Callaloo is not for everyone. It is a deep, dark green slime of unidentifiable flavors, a trip to an unfamiliar bush, a blending of surprises, a trip to another world right here in the D.
Oh, okay. So beautiful writers you find.
I know, aren't they amazing? Yes,
yes.
These are great. This group is particularly good.
Oh.
So she's got stories. And there's one called Making Bakes, where a young woman learns to cook from her dead mother. The dead are so real you can actually smell them. The people smell them. They know what's going on with the dead by scent. There's another one about a lovely young woman, Sadie, who loses the love of her life, Marquay, in a Detroit tragedy, the kind of which we hear
too often. Yeah.
There's another lovely one where an old man from the islands, his wife dies, he's left alone, he's had a stroke, he's speechless, he's in a nursing home down there in Grand Boulevard. He looks out toward Belle Isle or down toward Belle Isle, and he remembers the cricket matches the island people used to play there. And apparently that still happens. People from the islands come and play cricket on Belle Isle. Belle Isle becomes his heaven. At the end of the story, the nurse's aide in the rest home, the one who has befriended him, who tries to help him even though they can't communicate, he's disappeared. This is this sort of magical element that comes in here. She can't find the old man, and she looks out the window toward Belle Isle. And then she ends the story with this lovely, lovely paragraph. if she had heard the commotion south of the nursing home, just inside the island on the north side of the casino, if she had known the jubilation all of them were experiencing as the last batsman hit the last ball in the last innings over, over, over the boundary so far it couldn't be recovered. All of the players stood with arms outstretched and knees slightly buckled, wonderment and joy on their faces. Women and men spectators clutched their hearts, clutched each other, and clutched their children as they watched the ball's trajectory over the road, past the sun, over the river, heading west and out of view. And then this tremendous release of clapping and crying and rummy shouts coming from the entire casino area, pitch and oval, picnic benches, across the road over to the riverside. Had she heard the chorus loud as one voice, "Well played, old bye, well played, well played."
Oh, wonderful.
Isn't that lovely? It's like next time I'm in Belle Isle, I go there, try to get there a while.
Yes.
Look for the cricket matches, you
I
know?
Would guess
won't that
so.
Be fun?
So that's Lolita Hernandez.
That's Lolita Hernandez.
Making Hallelujah in Detroit.
Yep. And just at the end, I wanted to just read one little poem, a new book of poems by the poet Jim Daniels. Jim grew up in Warren. He's the son of factory workers, became one himself,
okay.
And then he got away, became a college professor. Although he's always looked at that job with the eye of a factory worker, which is interesting. Not many professors do.
No.
And he has never forgotten Warren and Detroit. Those cities have become the way he understands the world, and they have shaped him.
I saw a quote where he said that where you're from is like the zip code of your heart.
Absolutely. Isn't that lovely?
Detroit.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Around him.
Yeah.
Wherever he goes, it's in his heart.
They are the birthmarks,
yeah.
And that's the title of this book. His new there are lots of poems in this book about hard work. There are poems about the Detroit Tigers. He even makes poems out of our potholes. Most of these poems are pretty long and too long for me to read here.
Yeah.
But I did find one lovely little one about driving his children. And it gives a good sense of his voice and his absolute willingness to write really clear, strong poems about emotions. So this is a little poem called "The Gravity of Math." My daughter counts how many people will love her forever. She says two, me and her mother. My son says three. Does that mean you love me? She asks. He's seven, she's six. The moon is nearly full, dreams are silent. I'm counting how many slabs of gray stone I've leaned against. He admits it, buckled in behind me. I can see her back there. The lights pour loosely onto the pavement in front of us, spilling around the corner toward home. Feel my heart, she says. The world tilts. I lean into the turn. Isn't that sweet? Makes you cry, doesn't it?
Lovely,
yeah.
Yes. Every parent's heartstring
That's
has just
right.
been tugged. Wonderful choices. So recap them for us.
Okay,
if you will,
so
Keith.
So first there was Laura Kosciuszko's wonderful new novel, and you know, it's going to be, it makes some demands on you.
Mm-hmm.
The Mind of Winter, Laura Kosciuszko. Then there's a book of sort of personal essays and memoir by Sue Williams Silverman called The Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. Book of short stories by Lolita Hernandez called Making Callaloo in Detroit. And a book of poems by Jim Daniels called Birthmarks.
And that should give us a good summer's worth of reading. And we will be checking in when autumn's leaves begin to turn.
Looking forward to it. Have a good summer, Cindy.
Poet and writer Keith Taylor coordinates the undergrad creative writing program at the University of Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The recall notices just keep on coming. The ignition switch crisis took a big new turn Monday as General Motors recalled 3.4 million cars. Now that's on top of the 2.6 million small cars already called back for ignition switches that can slip out of the run position if the key's carrying extra weight and is somehow jarred. That in turn causes the engine to stall out and kills power steering, power brakes, and airbags. The problem's been linked to at least 13 deaths and over 40 crashes. This latest recall comes as CEO Mary Barra prepares for what undoubtedly will be a bumpy session tomorrow on Capitol Hill, a return engagement before the House and Energy and Commerce's Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee. Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Sambleton joins us now. Tracy, tell us more about Monday's recall.
So this is for about, in the U.S., 3.16 million cars. These are all older model cars except for the previous generation of the Impala, which they still make for fleets, but every other of the cars they don't make. And they have a very similar problem to this original scandalous recall that was delayed, in that the key allows, I believe this is how it works, the key, because it has a slot in it, allows the whatever weight is on there to like swing back and forth. So if you're going over something like railroad ties and it gets jarred, it can turn that car off into the accessory situation and then put someone in danger.
I know just late last week we heard the Camaros that are on the road were recalled for ignition issues. And
yeah.
So GM is clearly just digging and digging and digging. What have we got now? We've got over 20 million recalls.
Globally,
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's in a record. But it's them trying to show it is a new GM. Is that part of this?
Yeah. And I think it's proving to be a very difficult thing because they've got all these reports and they're now looking at them in a new eye. So they might have a case where somebody said, my car stalled. And now they have all this information to go back and look at that and decide, oh, yes, this actually is a safety issue. Now we know what is going on with those 50 reports that we got that a certain model is stalling. And they're digging and digging, and they keep on coming up with stuff.
And we know that this long, long list of recalls from General Motors, it's not all about Switchgate. There have been other issues.
Right.
There have been tiny recalls, some of them just 50 vehicles, but they're out there doing that. Are we seeing if this is helping or hurting GM in the eyes of consumers? Because I could see on one hand, people will say, well, they're looking in there, getting these problems fixed. But on the other hand, another recall, what's up with GM?
Well, you would think that by now we would have seen some impact from this. But General Motors is seeing only, if anything, a tiny impact. Their May sales were great. Their April sales were great. And I haven't heard anything about June sales. Mm-hmm. June may tell us a little bit more. But, you know, we're paying a lot of attention to this in the media. I think the average consumer is not paying that much attention to it. And they may have some recall fatigue going on here.
It gets, I mean, we're
it's
having,
not just GM.
Yeah, that's true. Because now what's happening, do you think? I have to imagine other automakers are looking and saying, we want to make sure we don't have a switch gate lurking in our vehicle. Not that particular problem, but something just as problematic.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that the other automakers are running scared. We've had Toyota recalling several million cars, but we're not noticing that. You know, Ford has recalled a couple million at least since this situation with GM. So, engineers who are in charge of in these safety committees are saying to themselves, not on my watch.
Well, and speaking of that, you know, it is very rare for the general public to know who it was by name who engineered or is responsible for the designs on the cars on the road. But in the case of these ignition recalls, that name of Ray DiGiorgio is all too well known, isn't it?
Yeah. Everybody I've talked to about this has this sort of outpouring of sympathy for this man. He was named in the Volukas report, investigating what went wrong, where there was this pattern of incompetence and neglect. Now he's no longer with the company, but apparently he's also implicated in this most recent recall. These parts went across his desk for approval.
And he signed off. He was the design release engineer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we found out in the Volukas report, after he signed off on the original cobalt ignition switch, it didn't meet company specs, and then he quietly okayed that new part 3 years later, and he didn't change the part number.
Yeah.
The other thing that, as Mary Barra gets ready to sit in front of that House committee again tomorrow, I'm sure people are going to be asking, why aren't these cars all fixed by now? But we think that so many vehicles have been recalled, and this is not a case of drivers being able to wheel into the dealer next week and get a fix.
Yeah, and of course, the committee members are going to want instant results. They're going to say, this is you're a complete mess, GM. But you know, I don't think that they understand how difficult it is to do a recall and get it done in a short period of time, especially when you're having to order a part made for a car you no longer make. It's
and this
very
is a
difficult.
Part made by Delphi, so
yes.
It isn't even GM producing the part. So
That's
the supplier
right.
has to churn the parts out.
Yeah, so we have this pipeline of parts. They're going to the dealerships, and those folks in the back there are working as fast as they can, but you can only do it so fast.
And I know they are telling people, don't put anything hanging on the keys. Do you think, Tracy, this could be the end of the key?
Mm.
And just push button?
You know, I don't know. That there have been some people suggesting that, but you know, you're talking, you know, other problems whenever you substitute something that you know works for a new thing. I really don't know whether, and in some cases, the consumer may not want that in a particular vehicle. So I think automakers are looking at it very seriously, but we're it's premature to say that we're going to move in that direction.
And the last few seconds we have, Mary Barra has that return date on Capitol Hill. She'll be accompanied by the independent investigator, Anton Valukas. What are you expecting out of tomorrow?
It's going to be another terrible grilling for Ms. Barra, but she won't be out there alone. She will have a former U.S. attorney, and she, you know, she'll have some answers. And the answers are, you know, this slipped by us. This was just, we were incompetent. We were neglectful. But he did not find that there was a cover-up.
Michigan Radio's auto reporter, Tracy Samilton. As always, thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
There are more than 500,000 kids in Michigan who could be eating free lunch this summer, but it won't happen. Many hungry kids who get free lunches or reduced price lunches during the school year are not getting free lunches in the summer. Michigan Radio State of Opportunities' Sarah Alvarez has been looking into this disconnect. Sarah, how many kids could be getting food help over the summer but aren't?
There's about 500,000 kids who could get free food over the summer who are not getting it, and about 68,000 kids who are.
And I know your report put out there that for every 8 kids who could get that free or reduced lunch during the school year, only one is getting fed through the summer. So how is that happening?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is because it's all up to the localities to offer these services. So it's up to individual sites like an individual church, an individual boys and girls club, an individual school to say, yes, I want to do a summer feeding program, and then to make that happen. So in some counties, there are 0 summer food sites, and in some, there are many. So that's one reason. And then even if a county or a town or a village has a summer feeding site, parents might not be able to get their kids there. Mm. It's the summer. So, you know, maybe they're staying home, or it might not be safe to send their child from their home to, you know, the elementary school. We know that in a lot of places there are not safe routes to school. Another problem that I have heard is that awareness of the program is low. You don't have to sign up for it. You just have to show up. So it's called Meet Up and Eat Up. And I think the state is trying to increase awareness of what this program is, and that parents can just show up or have their kids just show up, because only the kids can eat free. And if you're 0 to 18, you can eat free summer food at any one of these sites.
Well, you know, doesn't that make sense when you think of the hurdles so many families have to jump through to get any kind of help? That something that is just show up and eat probably is disarmingly easy to do.
That's right. So the state has a new number, a text service for people to use, and they can just text food, the word food, to 877-877, and they will get a list back of the 5 summer food sites nearest to them. And I think once somebody has an experience with a summer food site, then they understand the program.
And Meet Up and Eat Up really does say it all. The other thing I gathered is that there really is a hope that more concerned groups or even families might start summer feeding programs. What would that take?
Well, there are a lot of people in the state who are willing to help organizations through this process. So it can be a very grassroots community-based organization that wants to do this, or it can be a school district or an individual school. But right, there are a lot of people who run summer feeding sites who are willing to help. And then there's also an official at the state who offered his guidance to anybody who still wants to sign up and get some summer food to people for the rest of the year. Because, I mean, that's one thing about this, is that every site picks its own hours. Every site picks its own days. So some places might be offering summer food for 2 weeks, and some might be offering it for the entirety of the summer. So it's really all over the map, and for that reason, the more sites, the better. the USDA does say that they would like more flexibility in how they do summer feeding. And that's what people who run sites say as well, because like the USDA has their legislation is the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. And that legislation makes them kind of use this model of what of like school based mm-hmm. congregate feeding. That doesn't work very well in a lot of rural areas. You can't get to a school. Right. You know, where are you going to go? Like, you're going to be miles away.
School buses are not running in the summer.
Exactly. So that's an issue. And what the USDA wants to do is have programs like giving parents extra WIC money, giving parents an EBT card at the beginning of the summer that they can use. So when they go to the store, they'll have a little extra money in their pocket for summertime food.
That's what I was wondering. Can you put money in the parents' pockets to help through the summer?
So right now, the USDA is running some pilot programs. They've been running pilot programs in Michigan for the last 3 years. But this year, they're only doing it in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So it's only a few thousand kids that are getting that benefit. And I've talked to officials at the USDA, and they're hoping to expand that. Next year, they will have a bigger pilot, but it still mm-hmm. isn't going to come close to getting those 500,000 kids. So when the legislation is reauthorized in 2015, the USDA is hoping that they will have some more flexibility. But for this summer and for next summer, it's all about getting parents to know where these food sites are, getting more people interested in running summer food sites, and in getting some people in the community removing some of those barriers mm-hmm. like transportation or, you know, like helping folks to do a mobile food site and taking food to a park where kids already are at.
When you think of the fact that it is there, that the food is there, the ability is there, and to think of so many kids not getting something that would be so easily obtainable and that they need so much.
Yeah. I mean, one of the officials at the USDA said so many people think of summertime as this very carefree time for kids. And that's true. But for many kids, it can be a time of great stress and food insecurity. And I don't think a lot of people know that or want to think about summer that way.
Sarah Alvarez is with Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity team, and you can find out more about all of this by going to michiganradio.org and just click on the State of Opportunity link. Sarah, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed and produced by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattlesy, Taylor Mattia, Omar Sarday, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.